This episode was made possible by a grant from the Andrew and Marissa Fleck Foundation, bringing good things to people. What are they sponsoring this for? This is the Sarcastic Voyage Podcast. Episode 63, featuring Ron, Algar Watt, Matt Robotham, and Michael Charles Hill. You've heard their scathing class-based antics on the Sarcastic Voyage podcast, but have you ever heard them sing?
I like it quiet.
And I love to shout.
But when we get together,
it just all works out. I take two steps back.
We come together.
Because opposites attract, apparently.
Yes, Nick Hall's own beloved Lord and Master Nick joins his butler and slave for life, Willikins, to perform some of your favorite pop duets. This 40-song collection includes such hits as...
Please allow me to introduce myself.
He's a man of wealth and taste.
I've been around for a long, long year.
Stolen many a man's soul and grace, don't I bloody know it.
Watch you, who's not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are going to try to move your feet. That's you, you're my friend. I am Wonder Nick, and I like to say hello to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, the purple, and yellow. Take it, Willikins.
First, I got to bang, bang, the boogie to the boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the bang, bang, boogie. Let's rock. You don't stop, unfortunately. Rock the riddle that will make your body rock. Now, so far, you've heard my voice, but I brought Master Nick along. And next on the mic is my man, Nick. Come on, Nick, sing that song.
Check it out.
So we're not going to fight about this, okay?
Look, Willikins, I think I told you I'm a lover, not a fighter.
Now, from what I've seen, sir, you're neither. I've heard it all before. She told me that I'm her forever lover, you know. Don't you remember?
Well, after loving me, she said she couldn't love a mother.
Is that what she said?
Yes, she said it. You keep dreaming.
I don't believe it.
Find Nick Sings, featuring Willikins, everywhere imaginary music is sold. Introduction.
Hi, hello, yes. Didn't think I'd be doing that anymore, did you?
Back now.
Always switching it up on you. Or maybe it's not. You never know.
We're going retro on your asses.
We're going rogue.
Yeah.
So, this week, we're talking to, I've alluded to this many times, and I'm sure if you follow me on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, you've heard me go on and on about this. We are talking to a guy who wrote a bunch of shows in the 80s that I like. And I guess Matt likes too. I don't know. Who cares about this?
I don't care.
This is my time to shine right now, goddamn. No, seriously.
You owe me an interview with J. Michael Straczynski.
Look, you get him, and I will sit here and pretend to like Babylon 5 for an hour. That is totally fine. I'll even pretend I liked Spider-Man the Other.
Oh,
totally!
Wow, I'm going to hold you to that one.
Seriously,
so now I really like Spider-Man the Other. Yes, wonderful.
What's your favorite part about it? I liked when he died and came back as a spider guy.
Sure was awesome. Great when Aunt May put on the Iron Man armor.
Oh Christ, I forgot all about that. No, this is Happy Times. We're talking about Happy Times, actually. And again, I've said this before, and I need to say it again. John Callan, a friend of the show, he really came through. He met Michael Charles Hill someplace out there in Hollywood and said, hey, you know who would like to talk to you, and put me in touch with him. And really, John, thank you for that dream
come. We owe you a Coke.
Yeah, I totally. Send me your address and I will send you a Coke. Matt might even send you a Canadian Coke, which has writing in French on it.
Ooh. Nice. Don't open that, though, because, you know, things going to be a collector's item when France falls.
And French Canada.
Yes.
So yeah, we talked to this dude who wrote Transformers, G.I. Joe, Ninja Turtles, Gem, all kinds of crap, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But we wanted to mention a few things. Matt, you had In doing research, you discovered something.
Yeah, I wanted to do some research because I was a big Turtles fan back when I was a kid, and I sort of wanted to track down the episodes he'd done. And I found
you knew
some...
I had the Transformers thing covered, so you.
Yeah, so I tackled the Turtles, and I also tackled Jim because he refused to.
I just, I figured, who cares?
And Matt, according to my notes, you'll be doing Jim.
Right. Actually,
if it's for the show,
we could have brought special correspondent Ashwin on that. He has he wrote a book about that in an email, but we'll get to that another time.
But in doing research for it, I found the Japanese adaptation of the Ninja Turtles cartoon.
Now, just as a background, the Turtles were created by two Americans, right? Eastman and Laird.
Yes.
So this isn't like a lot of the other shows where it started in Japan and then we just dubbed it over here. This was an American idea that they took and ran with.
And like, it's very clearly influenced by the American like animation style. Mm-hmm. Like, it looks like that, and then sort of filtered through anime. The sort of main couple of significant changes, though. First of all, the Turtles have a tiny fairy that lives with them.
Not April, or is April there as well?
No, April's there too, but there's also a magic fairy.
All right.
For some reason, sure. Now, the other thing is that they have these things called mutastones. Basically, what
they
do is
kidney stones.
A little bit, only they're magical.
Oh, magic kidney stones!
Yes,
right.
Exactly as appealing as it sounds. which basically have the power to turn the Ninja Turtles into Power Rangers.
Oh, good.
Yeah, like sort of person looking. We'll put a link to this in the show notes because it's just fascinating. And then if turning into Power Rangers isn't good enough, it also gives them the power to turn into one giant ninja.
So basically they copped one of the coolest things about Transformers, which is smaller guys merging into one big guy.
Oh yeah.
Which I'm not saying Transformers invented that, because I mean Voltron had it and a bunch of other stuff had it. But
it's a little creepier when it's four people.
Yeah, four organic things and not.
Yeah, let's turn into one giant guy. One beat the shit out of something.
So it's more like Station from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Yes, exactly.
With an excellently huge Martian butt. Right. Oh, well, that's
they got here today.
Station. I'm always thinking Bill and Ted, man. Speaking of absolutely nothing we're speaking of.
Of course.
I was...
Wait, your segue.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm known for. These are edit points, believe it or not. I was explaining this to Amanda, and I was explaining that I do clumsy segues exactly for the reason when I'm editing and I'm not paying attention, I'm like, oh, change of subject. I better pay attention now. So believe it or not, that's deliberate, or that's the story I'm running with anyway.
Yeah, it's all planned.
Yeah, we are professionals. Look it up in the book. Mm-hmm. I was catching up on some stuff on my DVR, and as I want to do, and sure. Watching a bunch of Aqua Teens, like a whole run of like 8 or 10 episodes that I just fell behind on. First of all, that is not a show you want to watch a bunch of all in a row, because we've mentioned this before. I don't get high. I've never gotten high. I think that's who this show is made for. And in 11-minute chunks, I can handle it. But
I don't think that I could watch Aqua Teen high. I think it would start to scare me.
Well, fair enough. But in any case, I watched an hour or two of this 11-minute show.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed a pattern emerging. I noticed a certain thing happening. And I'm not accusing them of stealing from us by any means, because we steal from everybody.
Oh, yeah.
We don't have a lot of originality on this show. We're fine with that.
Yeah, we'll cop to that.
Yeah. We just sort of draw from the same pop cultural detritus as everyone else does. But there were quite a few things that we've done recently. It was just a weird coincidence, and it made for an interesting viewing experience. There's an episode where Meatwad, they discover he's like an earthworm, where you chop him in half and there's two Meatwads.
Oh, that's an awful concept.
Shake keeps chopping him up and like out of anger and making more of him. It was pretty funny. But the first time the second one shows up and they're talking to each other, he's like, "What's your name, Meatwad of the New Jersey Meatwads?" Hey, that's our joke. Of course, we've stolen that. But, and there's another episode where just they make fun of the clown, the Insane Clown Posse's lyrics for like 10 minutes.
Now, I mean,
we're definitely not the first people to do this.
Well, no,
we were very late to that party, as a matter of
fact. There was a time when everyone on the entire internet was making fun of that.
Yeah, but here's the weird thing about that. It seems like in the last couple of weeks, last month or two, everyone suddenly all decided all at once, we're sick of these guys. All at once, we've just decided we've had enough and we're all going to make fun of the Juggalos now.
I had assumed that Miracles song was like a new song.
No, it's from an album that came out last year.
No shit.
Yeah.
And people just suddenly realized, you know, this is retarded.
Now, maybe the video is new. But the album is from 2009.
Sort of give it like a wider...
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's...
wider audience.
Well, that's standard, you know, I assume still standard music business thing, where you release an album and then you gradually release singles from it.
Signals from it.
Signals.
But, you know... Insane Clown Posse, the Riddler's back in town.
To the Juggalo signal. But, you know, you put out one song in the video and then you wait for it to fade and then you put out the next one and so forth. Mm. So maybe that video is new. I don't know. But I know the album and the song have been out for a while.
Yeah.
But it seems like we all at once were made aware of just how retarded these guys were. And we all at once decided we've had about enough of that.
Well, I mean, I can understand the Miracle song, you know, everyone just sort of collectively going, okay, that's enough.
Right. But it became
fucking magnets. How do they work? Come on.
Yeah. But there, I mean, the comedy troupe, the Canadian comedy troupe that you like, the
Loading Ready Run,
they did a thing. Saturday Night Live did a thing. It's all over the place, just all at once. The Miracles thing just really took off. And I'm certainly not going to claim that we discovered it, because Adrian told me about it and somebody else told him about it. But it's just odd that all at once everyone's, you know, including the Aqua Teens, decided to...
all right, that's enough. Yeah. We're done with you and Clown Posse.
We've been quiet on this subject for far too long.
Listen, we've been putting this off for a while now, but we need to talk.
So yeah, it was weird suddenly seeing, you know, a week after we'd talked about it on our own show.
God damn it, scientists don't be lying.
And, you know, the reason your kids look like you is because of genetics. It's, you know, it's fine.
Actually, I think it is a miracle that your kids look like you.
You can't be the first one to have made that joke, but it's still funny.
Buzzing.
Indeed. Do we have anything else? We got a few letters here, but I think they can probably wait. We don't want to bother the famous cartoon man with our stupid mail. Or our stupid mail that's not for him.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what the hell?
He doesn't care what Flonk thinks.
let's jump into here anyway.
Alrighty.
All right, let's take this one from the Superior Lynch, from Brian Lynch.
Excellent.
As we record this, it's Flonk's birthday, so that happened. And Brian Lynch writes, "Dear Matt, you've kindly explained such complex things as Tim Hortons and prime ministers for your non-Canadian audience. Could we please have some clarification on the following, lightning round style?"
Okay.
Lightning round.
A Beavers, Lacrosse, Zed, Wayne Gretzky, Serviettes, Newfies, Degrassi, Mr. Dress-Up, Laura, Secord, Mounties. Go!
Okay, people actually say A. You've probably heard me say it.
Faster.
The rest is a myth.
No, you need to explain. You just need to explain fast. Go, hurry, do it.
Okay, well, give me the next one.
Beavers.
Charming woodland animal.
Lacrosse.
I don't know, my dad plays it.
Zed.
We prefer the pronunciation. Also, it was the name of a Power Rangers villain.
Wayne Gretzky.
Is he Canadian?
Serviettes.
I think they're like doilies, but spelled differently.
Newfies.
God, don't get me started.
Degrassi.
I don't know. Kevin Smith likes it. Apparently, it's some sort of high school thing. We had to watch it to learn about teen pregnancy back in high school.
Mr. Dress-Up.
Oh, he was our version of Mr. Rogers. He had different puppets, and he would wear costumes out of a trunk. They knew each other.
I can't tell if Laura is a thing and Secord is a thing, or if Laura Secord is a thing. Are they separate?
I have no idea.
All right, pass. And finally, Mounties.
For some reason, we think it's a good idea that our cops dress ridiculously and ride horses.
I think they're pretty cool myself. But,
all right, well, you know.
Classy.
They're not protecting your country, so.
And that's all the time we have. So now enjoy this interview with Mr. Michael Charles Hill, won't you? All right, our guest this week, I'm very excited to talk to. He has written for a lot of my childhood favorites, probably some of yours as well. Transformers, G.I. Joe, Gem, Teenage Mutant mm-hmm. Ninja Turtles. What else were you telling us, Michael?
Let's see. Dragon's Lair, RoboCop, Cops.
That's right. Your IMDb page is a bit of a mess. Like you, the names you rattled off aren't even close to what the internet thinks that you've done.
Yeah, I was flipping through that earlier.
Yeah, I'm always curious as to where they get that information from.
Yeah, that's crazy. Michael Charles Hill, I really appreciate you you coming on and making some time for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And above all, before we get to anything else, you are the guy responsible for one Cold Slither. Which has quite the cult following among people we know and mm-hmm. everywhere. And to the PSAs on G.I. Joe, which I only just found out recently that you had told me when we spoke earlier.
And that's guilty. Really cool.
Yeah, guilty on both counts.
and I'm not sure if you can really grasp that there's an entire generation of us, maybe even more, that just if someone says now you know. Immediately the response is knowing
is half the battle.
This is without even thinking.
And you're right. It was, I think it might have been a popular catchphrase at the time, mm-hmm. but I just assumed it sort of died out.
Oh, no.
Because I for many years, I had no idea that these shows had lived on sort of in the hearts and minds of not only our original audience, but now the children of our original audience.
Oh, sure. I'm in mm-hmm. my mid-30s, and my friends who have kids are now raising their kids on Transformers, G.I. Joe, and so forth. So, I mean, yeah, they're enjoying your stuff now, too, which is...
Now here, son, let an army guy from the 80s teach you not to talk to strangers.
And I trust you that you have seen some of the parodies that are...
Oh,
actually, we were gonna ask you about that, actually, because as the creator of those, I'm curious how you take that.
It was pointed out to me, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and at first I was kind of surprised, mm-hmm. but also I thought they were very clever, mm-hmm. and to me, when I wrote those things, I thought they were throwaways. I didn't think anybody really ever paid attention, had no idea that they would create a life of their own.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no possible way back in the mid-80s you could have imagined, you know, DVD or the internet or, you know, I mean, bringing fans together and giving us a way to watch the stuff over and over again and all mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Yeah, there's no way you could have known that. But it was amazing to me that you were telling me the way you guys produced episodes. I guess you would overwrite an episode? Is that the right way to say that?
Yes. We would write maybe 55 to 60 pages.
And, now, and what does that equate to in screen time for an actual animated show? I know for live action, it's like a page a minute.
Yeah. So it would be maybe half a page.
Okay.
Would be a minute. Because in animation, and I'm assuming it's still done this way today, I know I still do it, is that everything that happens on the screen, everything that you see visually, has to be written in. Mm-hmm. And... So in the old days, you know, the writers were gag men, mm-hmm. and it was really the storyboard artist who created not only the look of the show, but, you know, the overall theme of it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as a simple example, if you have a character who enters the screen from, say, left frame, you have to write that in. Or if you have a character running towards the camera, mm-hmm. you write it in.
So it's a lot like writing a comic book where you have to tell the artist exactly what they're, you know, what they're showing.
Yeah, and so in a sense, you also become the director.
Mm-hmm.
And you can control the look of it. And I really enjoyed doing that, mm-hmm. and it made the storyboard artist's job a lot easier as well.
Sure.
What would happen is everything would be animated, and then it would be cut to time, which I think... was, you know, 22 minutes for a half hour slot.
So you would write up to 30 minutes of animation, and up to 8 minutes of that would be just chopped out and thrown away?
Pretty much. And it usually would be trims. It wouldn't be like a whole scene.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sometimes tell watching. I mean, you know, the continuity more or less was pretty decent, but, you know, every now and then there'd be like obviously a piece of dialogue missing or obviously, but it never occurred to me that you guys would actually record the dialogue, animate it, and then edit it out. That seems you know, all the DVD extra features and everything I've watched over the years about animation, just that seems kind of wasteful.
Well, in today's world, it would be wasteful. Mm-hmm. And even Deke at the time, and I end up writing a couple of G.I. Joes when Deke was producing them, mm-hmm. you know, they were very thrifty. I think maybe our scripts were, you know, 30 to 35 pages long. Mm-hmm. And they were notorious for having a lot of static shots, sure. a lot of over-the-shoulder shots, so that the character who's, you know, back of the head that you were seeing, he was the one doing the talking, so they wouldn't have to animate it.
Just jiggle the shoulder a little bit. And You were involved. I my primary focus, obviously, is Transformers. I'm a big fan, and you happened to write, and I'm not just saying this because we got you on the show. You really did write my favorite episode and another one that I would put in the top 10, which is Starscream's Brigade and then The Burden Hardest to Bear. And I mentioned this to you when I talked to you before, and because this was, you know, one job among many so many years ago, you probably don't even remember, but when I was 11, 12, whatever, this was my absolute favorite episode, but there's like one plot point that gets reinforced and reinforced throughout the whole episode, and then suddenly it's just gone. And it drove me insane. And the way you wrote it, I can't imagine you forgot about this thing that you kept reminding us about. So I can only imagine they must have trimmed something out. I it's just no other explanation.
That would be my guess as well, mm-hmm. because I know myself as a writer, and I wouldn't if I was making a point about something, I wouldn't just automatically forget it.
Right, mm-hmm. exactly, and in the context
also,
of the episode.
It also,
oh, go ahead.
Right, and it also sounds like something that I may have missed when Marvel sent me a copy of the final cut, uh-huh. and I watched it, and I didn't see it. Oh, wait a minute. Got a very important scene.
Right. Well, but again, favorite episode, huge action and all kinds of stuff. The thing that got me was the character Starscream, played by Chris Latta, always trying to take over, always trying to be, you know, like second in command of the bad guys, always trying to stab the guy in the back and be the main guy. You're the only one who let him win. And I love that. I love that you let the jerk actually, you know, take over for a little while, and it's fantastic.
Well, he was a great character to write for. And again, I would always look and see, well, what are the other writers doing with the character or the stories they're doing? And I try and come up with, you know, a completely different idea.
Sure.
And also, it was just, let's have some fun.
Yeah, and there's definitely a feeling of that. And we talked about that before as well, where I guess the group of you guys working on all these different shows weren't, you know, entrenched in the industry, and so you kind of brought a fresh pair of eyes to this whole thing.
Yeah, as I mentioned to you before, a lot of us, before I started working on G.I. Joe and Transformers, I only worked on one show, and that was Dragon's Lair. Mm-hmm. So the whole animation world was new to me, and my background was film.
Sure.
So what I sort of brought to the table was, you know, thinking of these as live-action shows. Mm-hmm. You know, Steve Gerber and Marv and Len, you know, they came with a comics background. Mm-hmm. Flint, his background was games. So we all brought something a little different to the table, but because, as you mentioned earlier, you know, we hadn't been schooled in the old Hanna-Barbera style of doing cartoons, we sort of made our own rules because we didn't know that we couldn't.
Right, and to kids watching at the time, it felt very different. It had a whole different feel to it. Like, they're actually telling, you know, stories with characters. They're actually doing different science fiction stuff. That was the appeal to me for Transformers and for G.I. Joe, was the science fiction, the weird stuff you would come up with. And, you know, it didn't always make sense, but it didn't always have to.
Yeah.
And something like Cold Slither, where it's, I mean, utterly ludicrous premise, but just friggin' brilliant.
And, yeah, you know, and that was just maybe one of three or six pitches I made, mm-hmm. You know, just trying to get somebody excited about an idea. Mm-hmm. And, essentially it was just a Pied Piper story.
Yeah.
And then I sort of ran with it.
And there's, but there's so much, like, I don't know. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to make it sound like I'm just kissing your ass here. Cause really, I really mean this, but there's layers of like satire there. And there's like, I mean, at the beginning where you have like Cobra, their evil fortress has been foreclosed on and you have like the henchmen standing in the unemployment line. I mean, that's,
oh, I love that.
That's like a joke from like The Tick or Venture Brothers or, you know, something way later and more ironic that, you know, that was kind of ahead of its time in a way, you know?
Well, I recently read somebody's review of it, and he's talking about the loan shark that Cobra Commander goes to, who said he was right out of something that David Lynch would create.
Oh, yes.
But yet, it was 6 years before Twin Peaks.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that was an interesting observation.
Was that deliberate? Like, were you maybe a fan of Eraserhead? Oh, okay.
I was a fan of Eraserhead.
So maybe, you know, maybe a little bit there. Who knows? So now you wrote an episode for Gem, and there's definitely a story behind this that I'd like you to share if you wouldn't mind, because apparently it's quite a well-regarded episode.
Well, the story is that in addition to my duties as producer, staff producer, I also had a contract that I would write X number of scripts per year. And it was getting close to renewing my contract, and I think I still had 6 scripts that I hadn't written. And they didn't want to pay me not to write them.
Well, of course not.
So they came to me and said, well, you're going to write a Gem episode. And even though I had supervised most of the recording sessions, I really wasn't that involved in the show.
Sure.
And I didn't really want to write a girl show. I was the G.I. Joe Transformers guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to pitch, because Hasbro ultimately had to approve all the premises, all the pitches. So I wrote one that I thought there was no way that they would approve, because I did a story that involved Jem and her sister, or Jerrica and her sister, finding their mother's or their father's diary. And it talks about the history of their parents and their relationship and their love affair. And I guess Jerrica's mother had been a folk singer in the 60s and had died. So they grew up without their mother. So I created the scene showing how Jerrica's mother had died, which was kind of a ripoff of the Carol Lombard story.
Okay.
Which I think she was on a USO tour or something, and her plane had crashed into the side of a mountain. And, you know, she died in the fire. Mm-hmm. So I wrote that thinking, oh, I'm never going to go for this. This is just really pretty.
Yeah, I'll get out of this now because they'll never buy this, right?
Yeah, right. And they loved it.
Wow.
So then I was convinced I had to do it.
And you actually wrote a scene where a plane crashes into a mountain and someone dies in a fireball, and it made it into a kid's show.
Yep.
Yeah, that's because, fantastic. You know, one of the guidelines that we had was, with G.I. Joe and Transformers, is nobody died.
Right.
And we couldn't even use real bullets. It had to be lasers. And, you know.
Well, that's a handy parachute.
Blue lasers for, I guess, the good guys and red for the bad. I can't remember.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I think. I don't know. Someone, one of our listeners will certainly correct you if that's not right there. That's one thing the internet's great for, is telling you when you're wrong.
So then, follow up on the story, I was invited to attend GemCon, which will be held in Manchester, New Hampshire in September.
So they actually have a convention for fans of Gem. Is this a new thing, or is it an ongoing thing? Or?
I think this might be the third or fourth year.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you mentioned that to me the first time. My first thought was, there's a Gem convention? And then I'm like, of course there's a Gem convention.
Yeah. So I was invited by this very nice young man who it just so happens that Out of the Past, which was the title of the show, was his favorite episode. Mm-hmm. Because when he was a young boy, his mother had passed away. And I guess on the day that she died, he'd come home from school and turn on the TV and watch this episode of Gem, my episode.
Wow.
And so it was very comforting to him. Helped him to deal with his pain.
That's just so cool.
Yeah, that's fantastic that you're,
I was very humbled by it.
And a job you didn't even want in the first place ended up really making a difference to somebody. That's actually, you know, kind of a full circle thing. That's great.
Yeah.
So now you...
And going to Cold Slither, when I turned in my script, mm-hmm. and I knew that there were, with Jim, you know, they had hired songwriters to write all the songs.
Sure.
When I turned in my script, first thing I think was Joe Bacall said, okay, well, where's the song? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you wrote the script, you know, based around the song. Where's the song? So then I went out and wrote the song. Well, I wrote the lyrics for the song. Originally, my wife, who is a lyricist and a songwriter, mm-hmm. she wrote the music.
Oh,
and,
nice.
And Fundo didn't want to pay her. Ah. And as a working songwriter, she didn't want to do it for free. Mm-hmm. And the reason they didn't want to pay her is because Rob Walsh was already contracted to write all the music. So then I sat down with Rob, give him an idea what I was going for, and then he wrote the music to the lyrics for the song, as we all know him now.
And so now you're not only the author of that script, but also the co-writer of that song. So you get
That's correct. Credit. And I actually made more money. I made more money off writing the song than I actually made off the script. Because every time it aired, I collected royalties.
That's fantastic. I really wish a clean, full version of that song existed. Like, because in the episode, there's dialogue over part of it, and there's a Transformers episode where there's quite a big chunk of instrumental of it, but you never get the whole song. And I think if that were up on iTunes or something like that, people would buy the hell out of that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I do believe that somewhere in my storage unit in Vermont, I actually have a cassette of the complete song.
Oh, nice. Well,
so when I get back to get my stuff and bring it out to Los Angeles, I'll look for it.
And as part owner of that song, I would imagine it's in your right to do that, right? I mean, you can mm-hmm. make a couple bucks.
I would think so. I don't own the publishing,
uh-huh.
but I would imagine I can work out some kind of deal.
Next DVD release, throw it in as an extra or something.
Oh yeah,
that'd be pretty great. So you mentioned sitting in on the voice sessions. I wanted to ask you about that a little bit. You get to work with all these great guys like Scatman Crothers and Frank Welker and Casey Kasem. And do you have any stories about that? Or what was that like?
Well, yeah. In the beginning, We the days were really long. It could be like 8 to 10 hours long. And what we would do is we would do a table read. Mm-hmm. All the actors would come in, literally sitting on a table, and read through the script from beginning to end. And then we would record it. Mm-hmm. But after a while, a lot of the actors would double book sessions, and they needed to get out early. And then we ended up just recording, bypassing the table reading and just recording it from beginning to end.
Right.
And then that sort of segued into, somebody like Frank, who was very, very busy. Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure. He basically touched every single cartoon that was on the air at that point.
Oh, yeah.
And going back and forward 10 years from that point as well. I mean, he's everywhere.
So he might come in and say, oh, Wally, look, I got to get out of here by 1 o'clock because I got another session at 2. Can we just do my lines first? Mm-hmm. And of course, then all the actors would think, oh, gee,
Yeah, what's so special about him? Can I do that too?
So that's how, by time, after a couple of years, that's how we ended up doing it. Mm-hmm. But it made for shorter sessions. I think, doing it that way, it'd be 3 to 4 hour sessions.
Right. That's a shame because, you worked with a lot of great people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Scatman was great because sometimes he'd come in with his guitar and he'd play some old songs he used to record.
Oh, crap.
We'd take a break, every couple hours and sitting in Wally's little waiting room and, mm-hmm. and he'd talk about his past experiences.
That's amazing.
And, other actors would share their stories from different shows that they had worked on. Because a lot of the voiceover actors also were on-camera actors.
Oh, sure. I know Dick Gaudier, who did Rodimus Prime and Serpentor, was a big TV actor before he went into voice stuff, and I'm sure there's a lot of others.
Yep. He was on Get Smart, Roger Carmel, been in a TV series, was it like the Mother-in-Laws or something when I was a kid? Hank Garrett. Did you ever see 3 Days of the Condor?
I know the title, but I don't
that,
think I've
Yeah, that sounds that. Familiar.
Okay. Well, Hank Garrett is this assassin dressed up like the postman.
Mm-hmm.
So Hank used to do some voiceover work. And I remember him telling the story that he started out as a wrestler.
Nice.
And maybe back in the 50s. And he was like the Minnesota farm boy or something.
Right.
Well,
speaking of wrestlers on G.I. Joe, did you ever sit in on Sergeant Slaughter? What was that like?
I did, but with him, we literally recorded him over the phone. He lived in Connecticut, so he never came out to the sessions. But so we would just call him up, just like we're doing now.
Right.
He would call the dialogue over the phone.
So he would literally phone it in.
Literally phone it in.
Nice. That's really cool. So
Did they film his I don't even know if you know this or not, but did they film his live action segments there in Connecticut? Because I know he would do introductions to the show.
My guess is that they did. I don't remember, but if he didn't come out to do voiceover work, he didn't come out to do any live action work either.
I think those wraparounds came a little later, after the first run of the show when they put it into the second wave of syndication or whatever. So maybe. I'm guessing maybe his wrestling stuff was starting to wind down a little, and maybe he had a little more time. But I'm speculating. I don't know that. But you had mentioned working with Chris Latta. I really wanted to pick your brain about that because I mentioned before my favorite character on Transformers was Starscream, and of course we're all huge fans of Cobra Commander. I mean,
oh yeah,
you guys must have had fun writing for him because he was just fantastic.
He was amazing. Big energy. A fun guy, lots of laughter, but crazy guy too.
Right. Well, it seems like you really wrote Cobra Commander, all of you guys wrote Cobra Commander sort of as you went on, you realized just how ridiculous you could make him and how over the top. And I say that as a compliment. That's not a complaint at all. But you made him more and more ridiculous as the show went on. And Chris Latta just ran with it and everything you threw him. It was just great.
It was, it was fun to do that. And working with Chris was great. And he loved the character, played it well.
That's great. Yeah, you could tell he must have been having fun with that because you don't do readings like that if you're just kind of punching a clock and say, time to rant and rave about G.I. Joe again, I guess. That's cool. Now, were you involved with the movies for these various things, like Transformers movie and the G.I. Joe movie and so forth, the ones in the 80s, the animated ones?
Yeah, only a bare minimum. I was, I think I've given copies of the scripts, for some feedback. Ron Friedman, who I think wrote the original 5-part episodes, maybe for both G.I. Joe and Transformers, had a contract to write the movies. And then Flint and Jay Bacall wrote numerous drafts of the Transformers movie. I think maybe Buzz had more involvement in the G.I. Joe movie because he was a story editor at the time. So I had very little involvement. The two things I remember were that I had suggested, I think I'd seen Pixar's very first, and this is when George Lucas still on Pixar, their very first computer animated short.
Oh, that little, the short with the lamp?
Yeah, and I was just blown away. Sure. And I suggested to Tom and Joe, let's do Transformers, CGI.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they considered it for about 2 seconds. And everyone's fear was that a week before the film was supposed to open, I think it opened August of 86 or 87.
Yep, 86.
They were afraid they get a phone call from Nelson Shin saying, "Hey, I just got Optimus Prime, can move his head." As you can imagine, it took forever to render.
Oh, I bet.
Scenes, back in the day.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't weren't heavily involved with the actual, like, the story development for those things.
No.
Like the, okay.
No. I think I gave some notes, whether they were used or not, I don't remember. And the only other thing I do remember is I was grateful that I wasn't the one who had to tell Orson Welles that he was playing a planet.
Well, I was definitely going to steer you there when you mentioned the voice stuff, because we are... This is primarily a comedy show, and we spend quite a bit of time fascinated with Orson Welles' later years. Did you ever get a chance to meet him and talk to him?
I never did.
Ah,
there was right around the time that we were recording that, there was a tape that was kind of...
Is this the Frozen Peas?
I don't know if it's the Frozen Peas or the Paul Masson or something. It's just reaming out either the voiceover director or the ad agency.
Oh, yeah. We play that on the show all the time.
We know that one well.
Oh, yeah?
Between Matt and I, we could quote that thing verbatim. We're just utterly fascinated.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd been a huge fan of Citizen Kane.
Oh, sure.
Since I was like 19 years old. And I would have loved to have met him, but the last thing I wanted was
to see this great man in the sort of the twilight of his greatness, you know.
Yeah, you know, and he was wheeled around in a wheelchair and Wally's studio was, you know, up a narrow flight of stairs.
Oh, jeez. I know they ended up putting pretty heavy distortion on him, I guess, to cover up for the fact that he was sounding kind of sickly. That's a real shame.
Well, yeah, because it was the last thing he ever did.
Yeah.
He died shortly after completing it.
That's really sad. I mean, that's the whole thing about Orson Welles, is like he was this incredible, you know, virtuoso, and he somehow between that and you know, toward the end there where he's doing, you know, drunk commercials for wine and you know, doing the Transformers movie, like what happened, man? You know.
Well, you know, it's Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you kind of. Not everybody's lucky enough to have a career that lasts their entire lifetime, and
especially back then.
You got to pay the bills, kind of lower your standards.
I suppose that's true, but you know, as a kid, I didn't even know who he was, and so in a way, that kind of like Orson Welles, who's that? And then later on, Citizen Kane. Oh wow, that's Unicron, huh? Kind of a weird way to come about it, but that's, you know.
The tale of Unicron's rise to power and slow decline.
He thinks it would be fun to run a newspaper. All right.
I have no idea what they paid him, but I'm sure it was worthwhile for him.
It must have been. And I know in those days he was trying to get money together to make movies because he was having problems getting.
Yeah, he was always trying to raise money for his various projects.
Yeah. So, you know, and if he had stuck it out, if he'd managed to, you know, pull through, then you guys may have funded the next masterpiece for all you know, kind of an interesting thing. You had a cool story when we talked before about what you guys did sort of after hours, like you all, I guess, worked in this Sunbow office and then hung out together. Is that?
We did. Cause, you know, some of us were already friends before we started working Sunbow. Like Flint and I had known each other probably for 4 or 5 years before we worked at Sunbow. Mm-hmm.
And see, my initial question to you was, did you guys go out and get drunk or whatever? And you're like, no, we're you know, you basically set me straight that you guys were big nerds just like we are. No, we played Risk.
Well, we did like to drink. You know, we have long lunches.
Oh,
we were in Westwood, which at the time probably had more movie theaters per square mile than any other place in the country. Mm-hmm. We'd go see a matinee of something. Mm-hmm. And yes, Flint and I, we had a regular Sunday night Risk game for years.
Mm-hmm. And then you dropped a name on me that kind of blew me away when you were telling me as far as playing D&D.
Oh, yes. I think just before we started working at Sunbow, Flint got involved with Gary Gygax, and they were writing these Sagard novels. I'm trying to think of what the term was at the time. Not Endless Quest, but I mean where you could get to the end chapter and you could sort of choose.
Oh yeah, choose your own adventure.
The fighting fantasy books.
We sort of did that with Dragon's Lair.
The
TV series.
Oh right.
So
okay.
So Gary was living out in L.A. He was renting the old King Vidor estate way up in, I think, Benedict Canyon, sort of overlooking Beverly Hills Hotel. And he had an old carriage house that Flint had an office in, and we also had a big table set up for Chainmail. Do you know that game, that role-playing game?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, well, that's something else we did once a week was Chainmail.
Nice.
And Gary and Flint were doing these Sagar novels, and then occasionally it would be D&D night. Now, I'd never played D&D before, but the opportunity to play D&D with Gary Gygax as the Dungeon Master.
Oh, yeah.
I packed up.
Yeah, when you told me that just blew me away, because I'm not big into D&D myself. Matt's actually into that sort of thing, and I've never really gotten into it, but if I had had that opportunity, absolutely.
Oh, man. Just jump at it.
That's amazing.
I was going to say, Gary passed away a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And but I guess now there's a GaryCon.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Well, we've been spending a lot of time talking about the 80s stuff that I grew up with, but Matt is a little younger than I, and he grew up on sort of the second wave of your stuff, like the Turtles and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was a big Turtles fan, and my brother was a big Turtles fan.
I definitely wanted to give some time to that stuff as well. I didn't want to just focus on my stuff. So, I mean, Matt, do you have any...
I was reading your IMDb page, and you were story editor?
Yeah, a little backstory. I think I left L.A. in 91, and I went to New York City, and I was an editor at DC Comics. Prior to that, I think, was the first season of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I didn't really know much about them, and... I don't even think I had the opportunity to even pitch any stories for them. But what I do remember was that my son, who was 5 years old at the time, was a huge fan of them. But I couldn't even say Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in the correct order. I certainly didn't know who the characters were. So a few months after I arrived in New York, I'm in DC Comics, I got a phone call from a friend of mine who had an animation studio in New York, and we had worked together on a project for Nickelodeon that they ultimately didn't air. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, you know, a friend of mine is the attorney for Peter Laird and Kevin Eastman, and they're looking for somebody with an animation background to do some consulting for them. You know, would you be interested in talking to them? Yeah, sure. So I drove up to Northampton, met with them, and what it was, they were looking for someone, because they didn't have a background in animation, to sort of supervise the series that Fred Wolf had developed and was running on the air. And essentially all I had to do was read the scripts, make my notes, mm-hmm. and then forward them to Fred Wolf and hopefully make those changes. So I was the in-house story editor. I think David Wise, at least for first season, maybe the first couple seasons, was the story editor and writer for Fred Wolf film.
Yeah, what I had read or actually heard in an interview with him, listening for Transformers-related stuff, actually, was he was talking about the Turtles, and he claims to have created the base sort of character sketches that we're now familiar with. Like, he took the comics and kind of changed them for animation and made, you know, the characters. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, the design is dramatically different from the comics.
Right, but their personalities.
May well have done that. All I know is it originated from Fred Wolf Films.
Mm-hmm.
And to Fred's credit, the success of the Turtles, mm-hmm. I think, in my opinion, was based on what Fred had done. Now, Peter and Kevin were interested in seeing something a little different because it was very far removed from their original comics. So in addition to hiring me to review all the scripts and make notes based on what they wanted to see and, more importantly, what they didn't want to see, mm-hmm. They also hired me to write a Christmas special and to completely rewrite the Bible.
Wow.
A whole new show. And it was on the heels of the Batman animated series, which was brilliant.
Yes, it was.
And they oh, man, that's what we want. So that's what I gave them.
Oh, nice.
And as you can probably imagine, it wasn't very well received by Fred. And, but, you know, he was polite and was in a position where he had to review the material, listen to me, set up the meetings with Judy Price at CBS. Mm-hmm. And sort of, I felt like I sort of got him on board. But at the end of the day, what sort of killed the idea of a whole new reimagining of the Turtles was that Warner Brothers, I think, was spending about $500,000 per episode.
Wow.
CBS was only paying $250,000 mm-hmm. for the Saturday Morning Turtles. And CBS had no financial stake in the Turtles whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So their, you know, their revenue was just based on ads. Advertising.
Right.
And the show was already number one in its time slot.
So it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Argument to me was, what's my incentive?
Right.
I'm already number one. You know, why would I want to spend an extra $250,000?
Right. And I imagine at that point you do realize, oh, wait, I am writing a toy commercial and, you know, artistic integrity is all well and good, but, you know, at the end of the day, they're probably not going to care.
Exactly. So,
what you came up with would have been more in line with the way the comics were, a little darker, a little more.
It was very darker, and it was very, you know, much closer to the comic books, which is what Peter and Kevin wanted.
Well, that's really interesting.
Oh. They created a lot of new human characters, but I'm still proud of that work that I did. And in fact, now that Nickelodeon owns the Turtles, I've actually been trading emails with the director of development to see if I can get involved in helping them redevelop.
Very nice.
Oh, wow.
Turtles series.
Well, it'd be great to, if there's a chance that we could see, you know, your spin on it. I hope you get a shot at that.
Oh yeah.
All right. We have a few letters here from our listeners, and I'm going to edit as we go here, because some of them tend to be a bit wordy. Let's see here. Our first letter comes from Tidro, and she writes, "Dear Mr. Hill, I'm fascinated by censorship in Western animation. I'm curious if you were ever asked to change something you'd written to make it more kid-friendly. Conversely, did you ever write something you thought might be censored, but which made it to air?"
The only time I ever remember having to change anything was, and I think we talked about this episode before, Starscream's Brigade.
Uh-huh.
The original title was 30 Seconds Over Megatron.
Right.
And it was, for me, it was a playoff of the old World War II film, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was somebody at Hasbro went, oh, you know.
Don't mention the war.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, I gave it something a little more innocuous.
Right.
And Starscream Brigade.
But, I mean, that episode still opens with a flashback to World War II, and you have, you know, very clearly Allied forces firing on Japanese planes, and, you know, I mean, yeah, they got lasers like on G.I. Joe, but it's still very clearly World War II.
Yeah, as far as I can remember, they asked for no other changes than
just the title.
Changing the title.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's fantastic. So you made it out pretty good then, or you had a good sense of what would fly, would you think, or?
Well, I think that was always in the back of our minds, what we knew we could, mm-hmm. you know, what the guidelines were. I don't think we ever tried to slip anything past anyone.
Sure.
You know, we knew we couldn't kill anybody, so we never even tried to do that.
Now, let me ask you this. There's a point in the G.I. Joe movie, and I know you said you weren't really involved with the story development, but do you know, being around these guys, they had originally intended to kill off, I guess, Duke. And then they decided, no, we better not. Was there any kind of reaction to that? Do you remember any kind of?
You know, I vaguely remember that discussion, and it may have something to do with them just thinking, "Oh, look what happened when we killed off Optimus Prime."
Ah, yeah, that makes sense. No, it's really obvious, right? Even as a kid watching that movie, that they must have done a retake. Like, the way the scene is shot, it's pretty clear that he dies, but then they say, he's in a coma. So, yeah. Next question comes from Shauna, and she writes, as a writer for merchandise-heavy shows, were there ever characters you wanted to create that were rejected because they wouldn't sell as a toy? In that same vein, was it difficult to write for some popular characters that sold well but were lousy in premise?
Right. That was the one time I think it was ever done was in The Gambler. I wrote a character that didn't exist as a toy, and nobody batted an eye.
Nice.
I don't think that was ever done again, but I don't recall anyone ever telling us that we couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were a lot of incidental characters and that sort of thing that, you know, on Transformers and probably on G.I. Joe as well, that there never were toys for. Maybe you intended to make them and didn't, or I don't know, but... it seems like they let you guys, you know, create what you needed for the story, and it seems like they must not have given you a lot of crap for that.
Mm-hmm.
We pretty much had free reign. Mm-hmm. You know, every once in a while, I don't know if it was every 6 months or every year, but whenever they were gearing up for a new toy line,
mm-hmm.
you know, we'd get a memo saying, these are the new toys that are coming out.
Sure.
You know, we want you to work them into the stories. And going back to Starscream's Brigade, Combaticons.
Yep, you had five guys that you had to throw in there, and you did it.
Right, and that's how I dealt with that.
Yep.
You know, if there was a character that I personally wasn't really that interested in, it was a new toy,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just didn't write him into my pitch.
Sure, let one of the other guys do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Fair enough. All right, next question comes from Nat. A lot of questions about the G.I. Joe movie that you're not going to be able to answer here, so I'll just skip those. I could probably shoot this one at you, though, because you said you wrote for the Deke version of that show as well?
Yes.
So you did have to deal with...
I don't think I've ever seen them.
Really?
Yeah.
I wasn't even aware it existed until relatively recently. Matt, I imagine you must have grown up on those as well. The ones that took place after the G.I. Joe movie,
Oh, yeah.
Animated a bit differently.
Those ones I didn't see nearly as much of.
Ah. Because I imagine...
Yeah, I could say, I don't... Go ahead.
I imagine writing for that version of the show, you had to deal with a lot of the status quo that changed in the movie, where they decided, instead of being terrorists, that Cobra were these, like, snake guys.
A weird snake cult.
Right. Do you remember any of that at all?
Actually, I don't. It was Doug Booth, who worked with us over at Sunbow, was mm-hmm. the story editor, and he called me up and said he was doing the new shows at Deke.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I wrote two or three of them before I left L.A. and went back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't remember much about...
Fair enough. The gist of it is the movie...
Bible and the changes.
The movie created this whole new backstory that maybe not contradicted everything that came before, but it was definitely kind of out of left field. And we were all like, huh? And it sounds like the Deke show sort of continued on that vein, but...
It may have, and to be honest with you, I just don't remember.
Fair enough. Here's a good question also from Nat. How close was an animated G.I. Joe Transformers crossover to actually being produced? I know you guys every now and then would throw sort of a minor character in that would appear in both shows or something like that.
There was that one with Cobra Commander running around in Transformers.
I suppose that's true.
Yeah. I can't recall ever really talking about doing a real serious crossover.
Mm-hmm.
We had a couple of Joe characters appear in a Transformer episode.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously the Cold Slither song without the lyrics
appeared
in a Transformers episode.
But no, was that more because you guys had sort of limited production, you know, like... Okay, we need some popular music. Well, we already made this song for G.I. Joe. We already have the rights to it. Let's just throw that in there. Or was it a deliberate nod?
That in that case, it was probably the former.
Uh-huh.
In terms of bringing some characters over into, I don't think we ever brought a Transformers into a G.I. Joe, but bringing G.I. Joe characters over in Transformers was definitely sort of an in-house, intentional thing to do.
Right.
Just because. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, if you're producing all this stuff under the same roof anyway, well, you know, why not? But it sounds to me, talking to you, that you really, and I don't mean this as a criticism or anything, but you guys really weren't thinking in terms of continuity as far as, you know, you weren't telling some long serialized story. You were just telling 22 minutes at a time. So, you know, it's not like you had some master plan and, you know.
There was, I'm sure there was some nod to continuity, but not in terms of a serialized form.
Right.
I mean, for example, you know, The Burden Hardest to Bear, I can't even remember where that fell into the continuity, you know, based on the movie.
It aired the week before Return of Optimus Prime did, which was just a kick to the teeth. But
and we had no control over that whatsoever.
Oh, sure.
And that's sort of one of the reasons why we couldn't have a really serious continuity, because there was no guarantee, because it was syndicated in so many different markets.
Oh yeah, and they'd show them whatever order they wanted, right? I mean,
exactly. Now, another little piece of trivia was that I guess in the Bozo show, mm-hmm. and this is what got me into the Writers Guild. The Bozo show, in some markets, was showing like one act of a G.I. Joe episode per day.
Wow.
Wow.
It's kind of a continuing thing every 3 days or something?
Yeah. So one of my responsibilities as a producer of the show, in addition to writing PSAs, was I wrote Bozo's dialogue.
Nice.
To introduce each segment. Uh-huh. To tell you what you saw yesterday and, you know, what you were going to see today.
Wow. And that got you in the Writers Guild writing all these other shows didn't?
Exactly, because, and I think it still exists today, most animation companies, with the exception of, you know, like Family Guy and maybe The Simpsons, are not signatory to the Writers Guild.
Huh.
So we don't get residuals every time.
Wow.
That's insane.
But Larry Harmon Productions was signatory to the Writers Guild.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Apart
from that, you also wrote for another huge icon that goes back probably to your childhood, I would imagine. I mean, Bozo's been around for, you know, since what, the 50s or the 60s or something?
Yeah, something like that.
I watched Bozo when I was a kid.
Yeah, so that must have been a nice little thrill for you to, you know, put words in his mouth.
Yeah, that's how I got in the Writers Guild, by writing dialogue for Bozo.
That's fantastic. All right, next set of questions comes from Ashwin, our friend in India. These are very long, and I'm going to try to edit here. let's see. What I've always been curious about was the writing process for the episodes, because you guys really snuck some crazy stuff in there. Were there ideas that were just too crazy, ideas that had to be toned down or rejected? So it's kind of similar to what was asked before. Basically asking, you guys did crazy stuff. Was it just basically, what was the atmosphere like? Like, it sounds like you guys were just trying to be entertaining and not really, you know.
Trying to be entertaining, but I think, and I mentioned this in one of our previous conversations, a lot of the times an idea would start with, wouldn't it be cool if?
Right.
And then we kind of run with it.
And that's really cool, because you get that feeling watching those episodes where it's just like, well, he has a weather dominating machine. Let's run with that. let's see. Cobra Commander, I talked to you about that. I don't even think this one's a question. Sorry. Very long questions here. Suffice it to say, you have a very big fan in India. So you got that going for you. last set of questions comes from our friend Pat Loika. Pat is a great, a huge fan of yours, and I know he's going to be drawing his cover art based on, I imagine, G.I. Joe stuff. So that'll be cool. Cold Slither is quite possibly one of the most entertaining and unforgettable episodes of G.I. Joe. I've always wondered how that episode came to be, since it didn't seem like an episode with the introduction for new characters or toys. Was the idea behind it pitched to you, or did you pitch this in jest and ended up getting it made anyway? You've talked about this a little bit, but is there anything else?
It wasn't given to me. It was my idea, and I sort of went with the Pied Piper aspect of it and just ran with it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's like, wouldn't it be cool if we did this?
Sure.
And, you know, for me, it was just kind of another, I don't want to say a throwaway episode, but it was just one of many story ideas that I pitched.
Sure.
That everyone said, oh, yeah, this would be great. Let's do this.
Now, you did quite a lot for G.I. Joe. Am I correct in that?
Yes, in the fact that you know, in addition to writing, I, as a producer, mm-hmm. when the scripts, and we were cranking these things out. I think I told you before, you know, every Friday I had to deliver a script to Marvel Productions so they could sign it to a storyboard artist so they could, you know, get a jump on it over the weekend.
Sure. Now, how many of you were there? Like, how many other guys were delivering their scripts on Friday as well? Like, just to get a sense of the scope.
Well, Transformers is probably the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Although Transformers, I think primarily with the animation was done in Korea and G.I. Joe was primarily Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But it still was a lot of work for Marvel Productions because they were handling all of our shows.
Sure.
Mm.
So I also, you know, supervised the storyboards, mm-hmm. recording sessions, and when the footage came in and was edited, then they'd send me a copy of that, and I'd review it to order retakes because, as you know, a lot of times characters would be off model,
sure.
colors would be wrong. You know, sometimes it'd be a character with no head or with no legs.
So you try to do your best to get that corrected before it went out the door.
Yes, and unfortunately, you know, I think I was told, well, you know, we can only afford to do 10.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to pick your 10.
Pick the 10
you know,
worst.
Ones to buy the most, and we're going to have to let the other ones go by.
Uh-huh.
So,
wow.
That's really cool.
I know that there's still a lot of mistakes that people catch that we just either didn't have the time or just couldn't afford.
Oh, sure, because I mean, at the height of all this, you had what, 3 different shows running 65 episode seasons, just like
I think at one time, you know, we had like, of course these you know, this wasn't Saturday morning anymore, it's
right.
weekday afternoon, but I think, you know, we had G.I. Joe, Transformers, Gem. You know, and they were like the top 3 shows.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were doing 65 half hours a season, so wow. we were really cranking them out.
One of my question as far as G.I. Joe went, I guess, since you were so heavily involved, who, I mean, you know, kind of a softball question, but really, who was your favorite character to write for? Like, I imagine some were more fun than others. Some you must have had favorites.
You know, I was thinking about that earlier today, and I think Storm Shadow is actually one of my favorite characters, and I don't know that I wrote for him, but I do remember at one point near the end of one season,
mm-hmm.
Keone Young, who was the voiceover actor for it, you know, he'd come in, and he only had a few lines, and I turned to him one day, I said, you know what, I'm going to write a script just for you.
Oh, cool.
And I don't know if that ever got made. There was one script that I wrote, and I forget what the original title was. I think the aired version was, you know, like, Into Your Tent, I Silently Creep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, it was slightly different than my original version.
Mm-hmm.
Buzz Dixon, who was the story editor, had made some changes that at the time I wasn't completely happy with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I insisted that Buzz share story credit with me. And I think that might have been the one that you know, I had written specifically for Keone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm really very cognizant of the fact that I, you know, Starscream and Cobra Commander were great characters to write for, but other G.I. Joe characters I don't remember quite as well. You know, which was my favorite.
Right. Well, it makes sense. I mean, like I say, Chris Latta, you go to any kid kind of my age, even going down to Matt's age, and that's the number one thing they remember is that guy with that voice, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that voice forever.
Yeah. One more question also from Pat. As someone who is still writing, what's the biggest difference between writing for TV in the 80s compared to today, aside from the times, of course? And then he says, thanks for all your work and the hours of entertainment and for answering my questions. Cold Slither forever.
Well, the truth is, I haven't written any animation for television since probably the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of projects that I'm pitching around town. In fact, one just got pitched to Disney Channel yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting to hear back on one. So I really don't know what it's like these days. I don't know if they're still doing 55, 60-page scripts.
Sure. Well, but in a general sense, as far as writing, you know, writing for television in general. I mean, you're still writing scripts, I would imagine, right?
Yes. You know, today I was working on the third draft of a pilot script for a live-action TV series. So in that respect, it really hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
It's still the same as it ever was.
Is that anything you want to share with us, or is it maybe not ready yet? Or, I mean, by all means, if you have anything to plug, I want to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't really think of myself as superstitious, but I'm always reluctant to talk about something that's not quite
ready.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I always hate it when people get me excited about a project that doesn't surface. So I get you there.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. All right, I did have one final question for you, and I heard you mention this to me before, and I wanted to kind of get you on the record for this. You've seen the live-action Transformers, the Michael Bay movie, and you've seen the live-action G.I. Joe movie. I'm curious what your thoughts are, like what you think of sort of the modern takes on the stuff that you helped kick off.
I loved the first Transformers film.
Really?
And when it was first announced, I was concerned because I thought, oh, man, they're going to screw it up.
Right.
They're just not going to get it right, and they're going to screw it up so badly that nobody will ever be able to come back and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I went in with low expectations, but I really loved it. The second one, I didn't enjoy as much. I felt, you know, a lot of the action sequence, I felt like it was a video game.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I really loved the first one. I thought it looked great. It was amazing to see all the Transformers as real live characters. The G.I. Joe film, I felt I had to see.
Sure.
Again, I was convinced they were going to screw it up, and I was disappointed. It also felt like I was watching a video game. But I felt that, not that I want to say that we took it really seriously, but I felt like they didn't take it seriously enough.
There were definitely a lot of winks to the camera, every other line was like a real American hero, knowing it's half the battle, you know.
I felt like it was a little too tongue-in-cheek, whereas I felt like the Transformers movie was, we buy this. Mm-hmm. These robots really do exist in our universe. And
you
I bought it. Same way that years ago when I saw, the Roger Rabbit film.
Right.
Mm.
I bought that a cartoon character existed in the same universe that I lived in.
That's pretty high praise. I mean, as a fan, I gotta say I wasn't thrilled with the Michael Bay treatment. I didn't like the direction he took it. I didn't like that he focused more on the human characters than the robots. But hearing, from you, one of the guys who kind of helped build that is definitely, high praise, and I'm sure he'd be happy to hear that, it's appreciated by, you. So that's good.
Well, I actually was, my second thought when it was first announced was, well, how come nobody's calling me and asking for my input? In fact, I had met Don Murphy, one of the producers, years ago when he was just starting out, before he even ever did his first film, his first big film, anyway, that put him on the map, which was Natural Born Killers.
Mm-hmm.
And I had read somewhere that Michael Bay, I guess, tried to watch the animated shows and hated them.
That can't be a good sign for you saying, oh, well, probably not in the best of hands there.
But I would have appreciated a phone call to say, hey, they're thinking about doing this movie. And
now, did they talk to any of you guys? Did they talk to Flint or Buzz or anybody on these projects?
Not that I'm aware of.
Wow.
I know Flint is friends with Don as well. Mm-hmm. And I think the closest Flint may have come to was just his involvement with the video games.
Right. Well, and that's what he's doing now, right? He's more into the gaming end of things.
Yeah, he's been doing that for quite some time now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he started maybe back in late 80s or early 90s. And
oh, wow.
He did the James Bond video game.
Oh, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's good to hear. Well, that's pretty much all I had for you. I did have one final kind of a goof question to hit you with. You did write all those PSAs, and you knowing is half the battle. I got it. What's the other half of the battle? My fiance says it's killing.
You know, that works for me. I'm not sure that I ever asked that question myself.
Fair enough. No, every time she hears like that line, she just likes to turn to me and says, "The other half is killing." Like,
yeah,
I'm gonna have to ask
that,
him.
Years ago, Woody Allen wrote a book called "Without Feathers."
Oh, I have that book. I love it.
It's from I think an E.E. Cummings poem. Hope is the thing without feathers. So right. Woody Allen asked the question: if hope is the thing without feathers, but with feathers, what is the thing without feathers?
Right. Very nice. All right, Michael. Well, I really appreciate your time. I appreciate all your having to stretch back 25 years and appease fans of your. You know, a job you had a million years ago, and I hope you know your stuff is still appreciated to this day.
Well, it's great, and I appreciate it. And it's been quite a revelation for me in the last couple of years to discover that, these things that I did so long ago are still very popular and are near and dear to people's hearts and are still relevant in people's lives. So, it actually makes me feel a little more proud of the work I did. And had I known 25 years later, I might have tried even harder.
Well, we definitely appreciate everything you did, and we appreciate your time. And thanks a lot.
All right. Well,
take
thank
care.
You very much.
Well, I guess I'll download hundreds of boring podcasts.
It's all we know.
Hold it right there, young masters.
Wow, TV's Willikins.
Yes, it is I.
You smashed my door.
Pardon? Oh, yeah, so I did. Well, that's not the point. Were you aware you can listen to literally hundreds of hours of... Let's see, what was it? Ah, yes, the Sarcastic Voyage podcast for mere tuppence.
Wow, tuppence?
I don't know what that is.
Yes, why waste your time when you can listen to two braying morons try to convince each other that they aren't homosexuals? And sometimes they have guests.
Thanks, Willikins. Now we know.
Yes, good. Oh, yes, and knowing is half the battle, apparently.
The Sarcastic Voyage podcast is published weekly and is available via iTunes or on the web at sarcasticvoyage.com. Detailed show notes, related links, and alternate file formats are also available on the web. That website, again, is sarcasticvoyage.com. Follow Matt and Al on Twitter. They are, respectively, at RobotMatt and at Algar. Listener feedback can be sent to podcast@algar.com. An on-air response is guaranteed. All material contained herein is the intellectual property of Ron Algar Watt, Matt Robotham, and the featured guest, unless otherwise noted. The Sarcastic Voyage podcast is a trademark of Algar Productions, copyright 2010. He was a suburban child of the 70s.
Come here, Destro. Come here. Stop that, Destro. I see you both clearly, and I am stunned.
She had something in her eye, Cobra Commander.
My eye, she did.